Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Shalom.
And if we sound a little bit different than normal, it's because one of our microphones decided to be naughty, so we unplugged it and put it in the corner.
Yes. It might be on the Shack Stack. We don't know yet. We have to do some further investigation. So if any listeners out there would like to help us buy a whole new setup, feel free to... Okay, maybe not. We just...
If God is leading you...
Oh, Josh isn't like that, Charlie. Did you see that? He just leaned completely away from the microphone.
Josh, how you doing?
I'm well.
Good. So Josh and Tim are kind of sharing a microphone here.
Shalom, lechem.
So we can't ask them questions at the exact same time.
No. Well, that would be funny, actually. And each of them have to move at least, it looks like 2 feet to get to the mic. So there's a lot of leaning and lurching.
Yeah, because of aforementioned conversations that were off air, we just don't want to get too close.
I think the comparison was made to what movie?
Let's move on.
All right. So what we're doing in this episode.
Boy, that sounds a whole lot worse than it was, guys. It was a Disney cartoon movie. That's all we were talking about.
All right. So what we're doing in this episode. Hey, I feel like we are capturing a little bit more of the morning vibe that we used to have in our afternoon, which is good.
It's transferred.
Maybe it has something to do with none of us teaching this week. I don't know. Maybe that has something to do with it. So we're going to talk about C.S. Lewis, The Inner Ring essay. So this is our first... I'm trying to think of a word of entering into...
Segment. Oh, foray.
Our first foray into... Oh.
Nice word.
The Weight of Glory. That's the name of it. Yes. And so hopefully you've partaken personally, and we're going to talk about that. Andy's going to talk about The Inner Ring, and we're going to discuss it. Before that, we're going to do some other things.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
Woo. So I did not read anything. But I did go to the Midwinter's Couples Retreat and speak there.
The Mid-Couples Winter Retreat.
And I ran in.
Men's for Christ.
I ran in to Cameron and his wife.
Oh.
And we had a nice chat.
I know them.
You know them. And they were so excited to
chat.
Was
their daughter there?
No. Well, no. No.
I didn't know. I didn't know if people go to that if they take their like small children. But
They do. There were a number of small children there.
Like little.
Yeah. Like, well, I could hear them from the back. So, but yeah. And I said, hey, every time Charlie says the title, he always says Mid-Couples Winter Retreat. And they were very aware of that. And then they also said that doesn't surprise them.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty good.
We're posting this episode we're recording, we're posting next week.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'll say Cameron doesn't know this yet. We're actually getting together on Friday night for a surprise birthday party for him.
Woo!
He has no idea about it.
That's awesome.
So he's going to listen to this next week and be like, oh, wow, you got me.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the only other thing for my books and business is I want to give a shout out to my daughter. Today is her 9th birthday. Woo! So happy birthday, Abby.
All right. There's a book that it's a series that I've been listening to. And I know we've oft remarked at my utilization of AI, but I went to ChatGPT one day and I said, here are a couple of my favorite books. Give me suggestions of other books that I haven't read that I'd like to read. And this was suggested to me in the zone of like The Ransom Cycle or Lord of the Rings, like in that zone. And the sequence of the books, it's The Dark is Rising is the name of the novel series. The Dark is Rising. It's a 5-book fantasy series by Susan Cooper, published between 1965 and 1977. So kind of in the same time period, era of those other books. And the names of them, Over Sea and Under Stone, The Dark is Rising, Green Witch, The Grey King, and The Silver on the Tree. And the Grey King wins a Newbery Medal. That is historically a pretty prestigious award for a novel to receive. So this is in the zone of like Arthurian legend. So the first couple books, you get these stories of children who are searching for things, or in the second book, the main character, he's like, I'm gonna air quote this, the last old one. Oh, and like the old ones are people that can like travel through time, and he's kind of learning. That character's name is Will Stanton. He's the main protagonist of the whole series. He's learning the ways of the old ones from Merriman Lyon. And at the end of the first book, there's like this hint of like Merriman Lyon. And like you shorten the name and it's like Merlin. Mm. Like this is Merlin. And he's an old one that's lived forever. And like, so the whole series is like Merlin and the old ones and the fight against the dark, the evil. And so there's a lot of that like wonky, interesting stuff in it.
Is it a youth fiction or an adult?
I think it is targeted to young adult. And I would say it gets a, maybe I'm like desensitized to it in like Lord of the Rings. At times, this just feels a little bit too much of the magic, you know, Merlin, you know, all this stuff going on. Like, confusing, complicated, but I tried to go back in my mind to the first time I'd gone through like that Hideous Strength, and I'm like, oh man, you know, I have no clue what's going on here. But so it is interesting. Like, I like it. I don't know how good it is. I am into book three, so into Green Witch. And I would say, I don't know. I think I would recommend it. There's nothing like objectionable about it. It might just be a little bit more into that sphere of fantasy than I'm really care for, or, you know, not my taste, but I'd give it like at right now a preliminary, like 2 to 3 goodness. It's good. There's fun stuff in there. There's good things, but yeah.
If a listener had read some or all the Harry Potter series, and then compared the magic content there to the magic content here. Do you have any comment? Or because that might help locate it for some people. But maybe that's not a good comparison.
That's a really interesting question. And I don't know how to answer that. Well, like, Harry Potter definitely is, you know, the front face of Harry Potter is like this bright and bouncy, you know, wizarding school. And that's definitely not what's going on here. And so like the first book in the series, Oversea and Understone, it's the Merlin guy. It's his like nieces and nephews. And they're trying to find like the Holy Grail. And they end up, they do find it.
Wow.
And, but then there's like this evil group of people, the Dark, that are trying to find these things too, to like win the battle. And so we got to find it before them, you know, so the light wins. And it's just really kind of, you know, I guess that's in Harry Potter too, where you get like Voldemort and all that stuff. Sure. But yeah, it has a very different tone than Harry Potter.
That's helpful.
Very different tone. But there is like an adventure-y fun part of it for like a young adult series, but yeah, I don't know. I would have to finish it, see how it concludes, and then probably go through it again to like give a real assessment. It's just, it's not as captivating as some of those other series. But The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper.
I'm part of a book reading group, and we chose to read Complementarity, Dignity, Difference, and Interdependence by Greg Allison.
Oh, Southern Baptist Church historian Greg Allison?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Huh. This is a book about the patriarchy?
Yeah. the first like 100 pages, which by the way, I'm at like page 130 in this thing. I've got a few weeks to read it still, so I should be okay. But the first 100 pages or so are like a history, and he frames the entire argument around this book I hadn't heard of before. The author is Prudence Allen, and I learned that she's known as Sister Prudence. She's a Catholic nun, and she's written basically a 3-volume set called The Concept of Woman. And so he quotes her extensively in the church history section. And on page 40, he kind of summarizes the framework which Prudence Allen frames the conversation, and then Greg Allison frames the conversation in this way as well. So I'm going to read now. In summary, Prudence Allen frames her discussion of the relationship between women and men in four areas: opposites, generation, wisdom, and virtue. Okay, so those are the four. Now continuing, in terms of the first category, opposites, she presents five overarching theories of sex identity. Sex unity: women and men are equal and not significantly different. Sex neutrality: women and men are equal and not significantly different, without an explanation of the differences. Traditional sex polarity: women and men are significantly different, with men being superior to women. And so, and through the use of church history, that's the one that pops up a lot. Reverse sex polarity: women and men are significantly different, with women being superior to men, which is interesting that that did show up a little bit in the post-Reformation time period. Then number five, sex complementarity: women and men are significantly different and they are equal. So with that, I kind of got an idea of where he was going with the book. He's going to be arguing for, I think, at least it looks like so far, he's arguing for number five, sex complementarity: women and men are significantly different and they are equal. Personally, I didn't like how he's kind of framed the conversation. And I think it's demonstrated how people aren't looking at the conversation through this lens, because he'll highlight a specific author and say, they kind of lean into view three and then a little bit into view four. Well, if most of your authors that you're reading are kind of bouncing between two different views, maybe your views have like a problem. So I didn't really appreciate, right now, this is where I'm at with it. We'll see if anything changes. I'm not done with the book, but right now he's really kind of framed the question incorrectly. It's like you're creating a recipe and you have a bad recipe to begin with. And so what are you going to get in the result? You're going down the road in the wrong way. So that's my current take on sex complementarity. I'll be talking about it again in the future.
Well, with the honor students, we just finished reading the Iliad, taking a semester to read through some of the epics. And it had been quite a while, actually, since I had read the Iliad, and it was enjoyable to be back in. If you are unfamiliar with it, there is an incredible amount of bloodshed in the Iliad. It's a book about rage. That's the rage of Achilles. And you have the Trojans and the Greeks, or the Achaeans, fighting. And it's just an epic about maybe a week or two in this 10-year war. And there's the warriors go out and they have their moment of glory, their aristeia, where they're exhibiting excellence on the battlefield and they're cutting through foes. At one point, I think, I forget who it was, maybe Diomedes or maybe it was Achilles, I forget, but there was maybe it was Ajax, but more than 50 people slaughtered by this one character while he's on his aristeia. And so you might hear that and think, what in the world are you, why are you reading this? Why is this important? But one thing that's fascinating about the Iliad is the gods are really involved in conflict as well, way more so than they are in the Odyssey. And so we discussed a little bit about this idea of kleos, this what people say about you, glory. And for a Greek in that context, you receive glory, kleos, by dying on the battlefield. But the gods are immortals, and so they can never achieve kleos in that way. And so we had some really fascinating conversations related to that idea. The other thing that's fascinating about it is the main character on the Trojan side. So it's written from the Greek perspective, but the main character on the Trojan side is Hector. And for us as modern readers, he is a far more likable, virtuous character than Achilles. And that's just a fascinating thing to discuss as well. Why is it that we gravitate towards Hector? And the last thing I'll say is, in the medieval era, there was a book that was written about the nine worthies. These are nine notable men, three from the Greco-Roman ancient world, three who were Jews prior to Christ, and then three who were post Christ Christians, and Hector is the first of the nine worthies. It doesn't go to Odysseus, it doesn't go to Achilles, it doesn't go to Agamemnon. Hector is the one who gets that because of his virtues, because of his piety, things like that. So anyway, the Iliad, it's a very long epic with a lot of battle.
All right, let's have our first conversation about the book, The Weight of Glory by C.S. Lewis. So listeners, we're excited to have you here with us this week in our first installment of reading through the book. We are planning to read five different essays from it, and I'm going to attempt to cover the rest in my books and businesses this season. But the first one we're going to cover is the essay called The Inner Ring. So just a little bit of historical background. All of these essays start as something other than a written work for a book. And so Inner Ring is no different. It was first delivered as a speech at King's College in London on December 14th of 1944. Now, if you were to add up the time between when it was written and our current day that we're recording, the essay is now 81 years old. So if you have any grandparents in their 80s or near their 80s, this would have been written around when they were born. And so you might think about all the ways that the world has changed in those 81 years. But the note I have written down underneath this is that when I read it, it reads like it was written yesterday. Mm-hmm. He is addressing a human situation and experience that it sounds like he's describing my life and what I've experienced. And so it doesn't seem like it was written a long time ago in that it's not relevant to today. And off air, before everyone got here, Josh and I were talking about this, and I think you had said too that in other books that you've read by Lewis, he really writes in a way that it's still applicable today. And I would say that about his other novel, which will come up here in a minute, his novel, That Hideous Strength, the third of the Ransom trilogy. When you read that, you can't help but see parallels to stuff that's going on today. And if you have read it, I'll just go on record and saying, I really thought Biden reminded me of Wither and Hillary Clinton reminded me of the Fairy Queen. And it's like, I think at all ages, you'd probably see different leaders who are like that, but especially Biden, the sing-song, hummy way he like goes around. It was pretty crazy. The first time this was published, however, was not 1944. It was 5 years later when The Weight of Glory was first published and produced. So he gives the speech, and then 5 years later, when they pull together some essays, he takes that speech and puts it into the collection. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about the essay, The Inner Ring. All right, so maybe the best way to start this off is he gives an illustration at the very beginning of a couple of soldiers talking. There's a soldier named Boris, who's a second lieutenant. There is a prince named Prince Andrei, and he's a captain. And then there's the old general. And if you were to follow the chain of command, the general would have the most authority. And then it's either the captain or the lieutenant. I can't remember now. But in the little story, and it's a snippet from Tolstoy's War and Peace, this Boris guy enters the room and he sees that Prince Andrei is talking to this old general. Now, the general would have had rank over Prince Andrei because he was only a captain. But as soon as Prince Andrei saw Boris come in, he came right over and spoke to him. And the general had to like basically follow after and beg to be heard. And it says when let me find the quote here. He says, oh, I'm so sorry. I thought I had it. Boris now clearly understood what he had already guessed, that side by side with the system of discipline and subordination, which were laid down in the army regulations, there existed a different and more real system. A system which compelled a tightly laced general with a purple face to wait respectfully for his turn, while a mere captain like Prince Andrei chatted with a mere second lieutenant like Boris. Boris decided at once that he would be guided not by the official system, but by this other unwritten system. And he's just demonstrating that there are times where there are different rings or groups that have more authority than perhaps stated groups have in that situation. And so he brings this up and he points out that it's not just here in the army that you see these systems. You kind of see them all throughout life. So in the essay, he's going to depict the allure of being inside of these groups that he's going to call inner rings. And he makes a point that there's inner rings and then there's inner rings. And you can keep, it's kind of like an onion. You can keep going into the center of it. The essay also depicts the subtle way that the group exists. So it is not that it's stated. In fact, he goes to point out in this that you actually don't want to talk about it. Or if you do talk about it, you talk about it to someone out of the group to show that you're in the group. But it's not always stated. And then the way you get in or the way you get out is usually also an unstated kind of a thing. It depends on slang sometimes, or there's a point where he says it goes from, he says, if you're inside, then you simply designate it like you and Tony and me. Or if it's a secure group, you might say it's we. Or it might be expanded to meet a particular emergency. It calls itself all the sensible people in this place. And I thought that was particularly good because I'm sure we've all been in a job at one point where the management just doesn't get it. And we three or we two or whatever, we see the real thing. And I've never thought about like me, if I've ever made those statements in the past, being like me part of an inner ring. But there is like a little bit of we're together on this. And then the essay demonstrates that these rings aren't necessarily wrong in and of themselves. In fact, he goes to great pains to say it's a pretty normal thing to have friends at work and have little meetings, and it's important to do that. But he does point out that the motive behind the desire to join into these special groups is often sinful. Primarily, he's going to have two kinds of sinfulness. So let's just go ahead and skim through the article and grab a couple of thoughts from here and there. And then I'll have a couple more comments for us here at the end. So if you're inside, we were talking about the labels. He says, and this would be probably around page 144, reader or listener, from the inside, it may be designated in simple cases by mere enumeration, like numbers. It may be called you, Tony, and me. When it's very secure and comparatively stable in membership, it calls itself we. When it has to be suddenly expanded to meet our particular emergency, it calls itself all the sensible people in this place, which I thought was interesting. Now he flips it. He says, what's an inner ring labeled when you're outside of the ring? He says, from the outside, if you have despaired of getting into it, you call it that gang, or they, or so-and-so in his set, or the caucus, or the inner ring. Now notice, the first time the inner ring comes up, it's kind of a pejorative term. You're an outsider, and you've been not allowed membership. And so you're like, ah, his inner ring. And so I think we've all probably been in a situation like this, where we've seen that there's kind of a group we'd like to be a part of, and maybe that's guided us at times. So Lewis talks about how that, it's funny, I felt like when he described the inner ring, I got the feel of the way you describe a morsel of gossip that you heard or want to hear. So he makes this comment. An invitation from a duchess would be a very cold comfort to a man smarting under the sense of exclusion from some artistic or communist courtier. Poor man, it is not large lighted rooms or champagne or even scandals about peers and cabinet ministers that he wants. Okay, so those are all the things in the group. He says, it is the sacred little attic or studio, the heads bent together, the fog of tobacco smoke, and the delicious knowledge that we four or five, all huddled behind this beside this stove, are the people who know. So as he presented that, it almost sounded like something illicit. That makes sense? Like something that I shouldn't want, and I don't want people to know that I want, but I really want it. And so I started to ask some questions about this. What do you got, Josh?
Well, I just was going to say, in that section, I think he's just making the point that some people want to be in the inner ring of society, but for somebody who has communist leanings, that has no attraction to him. But what does have attraction is being in the upper attic with other revolutionaries that are plotting And so he's just saying we all have an inner ring that appeals to us, but we don't all have the same inner ring that appeals to us. That's how I understood it.
That went over in my head. So I saw the communist Coitier or whatever, and I was like, oh, yeah, I that totally went over my head. Thank you for that. Total side note, there's a book I read part of back in the day called Midnight at Chernobyl, and it talks about how the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown was kind of the result of communist party leadership. And it was interesting to talk about how you kind of rise the ranks of communist leadership and how you don't. And it is like pleasing the people above you so they invite you up. It's really, that's fascinating. Thank you. So it is interesting that he kind of comes off against these inner rings, but he wants to make a distinction, and this is near page 148, and there's a paragraph that starts, I must now make a distinction. And he doesn't want you to, I think as he's starting to address this group, if you're not thinking clearly with him or closely with him, you might wonder, can I ever be in a small group? So how many of us are sitting at the table right now? Mm-hmm. Four. Are we an inner ring? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Josh is saying yes. Okay, but aren't we supposed to keep it a secret or something, or keep people out? Sounds like as we invite our listeners. Huh?
Speak for yourselves, you tramps.
Horrendous.
And anyways, moving on. So he says, I must now make a distinction. I am not going to say that the existence of inner rings is an evil. It is certainly unavoidable. There must be confidential discussions, and it is not a bad thing in and of itself. It is a good thing that there's personal friendship that should grow between those who work together. And it is perhaps impossible that the official hierarchy of any organization should quite coincide with its actual workings. I thought that was fascinatingly true. So if you're a king, I'm trying to remember in Ecclesiastes where I remember reading this, but it says like the king can't share everything he knows. Like he's not expected. Do you remember that part? I did not look this up ahead of time.
No. I mean, I think of chapter 8 where, you know, if you're like the lowly guy and you're just speaking, you're supposed to be the wise person advising the king. So in chapter 8, you know, you're taking your life into your hands by bringing something up because he could chop your head off. And so there's like, who is that guy? He's outside the inner ring.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure.
And so then he's going to maybe say something, and then how's the king going to receive it? Should he say something? And it's kind of that kind of a scenario.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of a proverb then, maybe in the like 20, 25 to 30 range, where it talks about a king can't share all his thoughts. Like mm-hmm. you just have to kind of submit kind of an idea.
Yeah.
I'm getting that wrong.
I think that is a proverb that you're thinking of.
It's a vague memory.
But as we were reading through this, I was thinking of the wisdom literature. Oh yeah, and Ecclesiastes on multiple fronts, because the king doesn't necessarily listen to the people that are up there with him. How sometimes it might be somebody that's lower that has a greater influence.
Even so, when it talks at some point in here about trying to get in, it does talk about like sort of buttering people up and appealing to them. And I did think of the passage that says like you speak very gently with the king and you kind of tread lightly. So I would agree with you on that.
I think also biblically, I mean, Christ has his disciples. But then even within the disciples, he has the three that he works very closely with, Peter, James, and John. And that's a natural inner ring. There's nothing sinful about that. Christ is the one that is taking these three with him, Mount Transfiguration, things like that. But what's interesting is that you see the disciples then begin to desire to be in the inner ring. And
that's,
you know,
good.
Who's going to sit at your right hand, kind of thing. And so they show how the inner ring can so quickly become something that's a sinful desire.
That's really good. So I'm just gonna skip ahead a little. So inner rings are not inherently evil, but the desire to be in one could be. And so to start laying this case, he quotes Byron, and in the quote from Byron, he says, "A sweet is a legacy. And passing sweet, the unexpected death of some old lady." Now, I have to confess, when I was listening to this in the car after reading it more than once, I'm like, what in the world is this talking about? And Byron, correct me if I'm wrong, he's a romantic poet, correct? And so Lewis goes on, thankfully, to explain right away. He says, "The painless death of a pious relative at an advanced age is not an evil. but an earnest desire for her death on part of her heirs, and this is like the most understated comment ever, is not reckoned a proper feeling. And law frowns even on the gentlest attempt to expedite her departure. I'm like, that is the most gentle, obscure way of talking about like hiring a hit on your aging relative because you'd like to inherit their inheritance. But I do think it was a really good meta or a really good parallel situation. So if an old relative dies who had a goodly life and is very pious, that can be a good thing because they go in to be with the Lord. But desiring that death for selfish ends is wrong. And so I do think when he talks about the inner ring here, the motivation is going to become central. And so I saw two motivations in this chapter. And so I'm going to skip ahead to page 153. And there's a couple of things that have been mentioned already. but there's a paragraph that starts off, and it's a pretty long one. It would be polite and charitable and in your view of age reasonable too to suppose that none of you is yet a scoundrel. And he's going to talk in that paragraph about how you become a scoundrel. And in it, he essentially is talking about the insidious nature of the offer to be in the ring. Like you want to be in it and it almost works on you against your will. He has a very poignant sentence down here. He says something about something which even the outsiders in your own profession are apt to make a fuss about. Oh, let me back up. I'm so sorry. I missed the beginning. He said, it will be the hint of something which is not quite in accordance with the technical rules of fair play. Something which the public, the ignorant, the romantic public, would never understand. Something which even outsiders in your own profession are apt to make a fuss about. But something, says your friend, which we, and at the word we, you try not to blush for mere pleasure. Something we always do. And you will be drawn in. If you are drawn in, not by the desire for gain or ease, but simply because at that moment when the cup was so near your lips, you cannot bear to be thrust back again into the cold outer world. It would be so terrible to see that other man's face, that genial, confidential, delightfully sophisticated face, turn suddenly cold and contemptuous to know that you had been tried for the inner ring and rejected. Now, when I hear the language of rejection, the vice that I immediately think of is pride. And I think as I look back in my life, there have been times I've wanted to be a part of things. And the thing I wanted to be a part of was not in and of itself wrong, but my motivation was pride. So I think through this chapter, though he doesn't explicitly state it, I think pride is the one motivation. Now he goes on to the second. He makes like two reasons. And he, at the end of this paragraph, has a statement. He says, that is my first reason. Now, I think it's pride, but then he says this, of all passions, the passion for the inner ring is the most skillful in making a man who is yet very bad to do very bad things. Now, I'm going to pause. I want to make a quick foray into a book called That Hideous Strength, and then we'll go back to the second motivation I see for why people want to be in inner rings. That's like a bad motivation. So, my favorite novel by Lewis is the third in the Ransom trilogy, That Hideous Strength. And the character who I most love of all his characters is Mark Studdock. I think of Mark Studdock as an embarrassing doppelganger of myself. He wants acclaim and he isn't all that bright, but he kind of has some, you know, stuff he's doing and he's even an educator. And so there are times at which I just see my own pride and it's probably, you know, I think probably all of us are going to see some pride when we look at the character of Mark Studdock. But what happens is he has a teaching position and he's constantly trying to better his job and be like higher. And so he knows this guy named Curry is kind of important. So he kind of cozies up to Curry. He does business lunches with him. He stays late at work because he's trying to get kind of higher in his job. Eventually, he becomes part of a group called the NICE, the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. And as he joins it, his wife has some serious issues with it, but he's like, oh, I'll only be gone a couple of weeks and it'll be really good for us. And he kind of doesn't listen to his wife's suspicions. And then as he's driving to this on the first day, he's with Lord Featherstone or Dick Devine. He's been in all the books. And the way he's driving and the way he's talking, you can hear Mark's inner monologue. And Lewis paints it in such a way where you can tell Mark is uncomfortable. But he's trying to, like, ignore all that because what he wants is coming right in front of him. He gets into the NICE and he starts to be told to do things. And they're things that aren't absolutely terrible. They're a little bit innocuous, but they're not really very right. But it's just a little thing. And over time, it gets, like, progressively more and more, like, evil to the point where there is a future event that has not happened. And he, having English skill, because I think he's some sort of a professor of English, if I remember correctly, is told to write an article for this newspaper that's going to come out tomorrow about a riot that's going to happen, that happened in the city and all these people died. And he's like, but that's tomorrow. I don't know if there's going to be a riot there. And he's like, oh, we'll make it happen. Write the story now, though. So the, and now, can we say prophetic people? like how many things have come out on the internet 2 hours before they actually happened? Anyways, so, hey, you know what I'm talking about. So he basically does worse and worse things, and the internal turmoil of his conscience is kind of shown. And he essentially wants, he doesn't want to do those things, but he really wants to feel a part of something. And he wants to be part of something that's like knowing. Okay, so this group knows, like nobody else knows, but this group does, and he wants to be in the know. Secondly, there's talk about this group that makes it sound like it's really important. And if he's doing this, his life will be important. And then thirdly, I think I would just say there's like a level of speciality. You're special, you're different, you're like a level above. And so he ends up going against his own conscience and his own morals. And that's exactly what Lewis warns us about in this essay. He says, my page flipped, sorry. He says, the passion of the inner ring is the most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. And the story of Mark Stuck is a man who wasn't very bad, but he ended up doing very bad things. Now, in the end, you can read the story. There's some good, it ends in a good way. Now, the second reason he talks about, and he kind of mentions the idea of fear. So he gives this illustration of these Danaids. Now, did you look up the Danaids, Josh? Can you give us a summary?
The Danaids. Okay. Apparently, they were 50 daughters of King Danis, and they were supposed to, or they were punished for killing their husbands. I think there is only one that survived, but they killed 49 husbands, and so they're punished, and he describes the punishment.
Okay. And the punishment is that they have to attempt to fill sieves with water, but all of them have holes in it, so there is just going to be this eternal project they have to do that will never come to an end. And so Lewis says this. He says, the torture allotted to the Danaids, thanks for that pronunciation, in the classical underworld is a symbol not of one vice, but of all the vices. It is the very mark of a perverse desire that it seeks what is not to be had. The desire to go inside the invisible line illustrates this rule. As long as you are governed by that desire, you will never get what you want. You are trying to peel an onion. If succeeded, there will be nothing left. Until you conquer the fear of being an outsider you will remain. So I think the other element that's come up a number of times as far as vice goes, or motivation, I think there's just a general idea of fear. Sometimes you want to be part of the inner ring because you're afraid. You're afraid of being an outsider, and you're not just, I'm just going to be comfortable as an outsider. So I think pride and I think fear are the two main motivations. Now, I'll stop there. There's more to say, and I'll ask you guys for your comments here in a minute. But I've really appreciated the essay. A friend of mine kind of pointed it out to me about 10 years ago. as one of the main ones you want to read. And then after this, I had read That Hideous Strength. And usually when we think of That Hideous Strength, we think of a different essay by Lewis. Anyone want to guess what that essay is? There's another essay that actually is like the embodiment of this. Mm-hmm. It's Abolition of Man. Oh. Abolition of Man is like the whole thing is just right here. You see it all throughout. But the inner ring, I had forgotten how much a part of this story this essay is. Now, this is just for fun. It's intriguing to think about the timelines here. So he gives this speech December 14th, 1944. 8 months and 1 week later, he publishes That Hideous Strength. So these two are published within a year of each other. And then 5 years later, The Weight of Glory is published with this essay in it. So if you're thinking, what does the world see of these ideas? First, they see That Hideous Strength and they can read that. And then 5 years later, you get an essay that I think was really, really central to it. So I'll just turn it over to you guys. What did you find particularly helpful in the book? What did you find particularly confusing? Or do you have any quotable nuggets or anything else you want to talk about?
A book that we've talked about in the past, particularly you, Charlie, The Great Gatsby. I was reading this, and because I don't have the familiarity that you have with The Hideous Strength, but I was thinking of Jay Gatsby and Nick Carraway, and that passage that you read brings making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. So this is a story, The Great Gatsby, a story of Midwesterners that are now in New York, and, you know, Gatsby's chasing after Daisy, and he needs to get her, and so he... That's a noble goal, not the fact that she's a married woman now. That's not noble, but love is motivating him, but it takes him down these very, he perverts it, takes him down these very dark paths. So I was thinking a lot of that book as I was reading this.
Yeah, that's a connection that I had not made in my mind, but something that, you know, we've talked about ad nauseum on our podcast because it's so a part of life, is just the cultivation and the order of affections. Mm-hmm. And this is that.
Yep.
It's just lived out in one area.
Yep.
And here's a sentence that he, and I don't know what page this is on. I have like a PDF pulled up, but he says this: "My main purpose in this address is simply to convince you that this desire is one of the great permanent mainsprings of human action."
Yes.
So why is he writing this? You, for the rest of your life, will have this temptation to want to be in, and you'll be thrilled when you are, and you will be in anguish when you're left out. And if you don't recognize that about yourself and understand what's happening, you will have disappointment, and it will lead you morally in a wrong direction. To understand that desire and to turn away is the correct path of cultivating a right love of human relationship. So that's in the end, it's a very simple idea, but I think we can all see how that lives itself out in so many areas of our lives. But
yeah, on that same kind of idea, like I was thinking of just teenagers, and even thinking about this, isn't that long of an article. It didn't take that long to read. It'd be a great discussion point even with my kids. Because the desire to be included in a specific social group. So when we think of all the people pleasing and the peer pressure, the fear of a man in its actual practical living it out. So your quote was from page 151. And then a quote that I had from page 150, "In the whole of your life, as you now remember it, has the desire to be on the right side of the invisible line ever prompted you to an act or word on which, in the cold small hours of a wakeful night, you can look back with satisfaction?" In other words, the desire to be in is really what's driving you to do something. Mm-hmm. And then how that can lead, like Charlie mentioned, to the vices, which he does mention, but not very much. He doesn't make a big deal of it, the vices aspect of it. It's on page 148. And he deals with promiscuity and then smoking and getting drunk. How many times did people get drunk? Yeah. Why?
Yeah.
They want to be in.
Yeah.
Yep.
They will be connected to the group.
I thought that was super observant because how many that was just that one surprised me.
So just to, I want to go down the route of that Hideous Strength a little more, mm-hmm. and just for the listener, if you haven't read it, there are a lot of I think it's probably 150-151. This quote, Lewis, I have no right to make assumptions about the degree to which any of you may already be compromised. So like, talk about language of like, you have given in, and like, it's like almost like spy language, like you're compromised. The information's gone. Like, you're on the wrong side. But the next sentence is where I'm going to read that in a second. But, you know, so we don't know how deep people are into this. But the relationships in Mark Studdock's life mm-hmm. that are compromised because he is after yes. something else. And what does it compromise? So like the opening scenes of this book is a broken marriage.
Yes, absolutely.
And he is like after the affections of this little group of people at his college and has no idea the erosion that's happening in his wife's life. And it has a happy ending. Has a happy ending. So you should read it for that purpose. So it's out of this world, may we say.
Well done.
Anyway, so, but then the scene that we've joked about a number of times, because we've all been in, you know, meetings, you know, out of college, but it's like the sale of college property. That's chapter one. I think it's one of the early.
It's like, early. It's really early. Yeah.
So like, there's this faculty meeting taking place at this college, and the people who are up front talking, working through the agenda, they aren't the ones that have the power, and so you're just watching that, and like the strings are getting pulled, and like it's just like people are being led down a decision to something that happened, and it's like, so who you think would be in control is not in control, and so the way I'm thinking here is like where, you know what. Context do we see this happening in our world, you know, it's like and trying to put it into like church, like the different desires of like just maybe the assumption of little groups of people in church, like who are the fun people, who are the more spiritual people, who aren't the weird people, you know, like, well, that those they take it a little too seriously and we're the normal ones and, you know, they don't really understand this thing. And if you don't think that's happening in your church, you're not like aware. Like those little nudges and jostlings are happening in people's hearts all over the place in a church. And so like the pull to be like on the right side of a decision in a meeting, or, you know, to be on the pastor's good side, or, you know, to not be the one in the wrong, like this could be just driving people's relationship in the church. And that is kind of a thought I thought could be really practical to talk about, is how do we avoid that on a church level?
That's interesting that you bring up the church. I really like that, because Lewis almost seems like he just wants to alert you that this is a possibility and you should think about it. But looking in my life, I don't think, even reading this essay, I don't think I saw these sorts of sinful motivations and desires until I was older. And so is it possible that there are some people who initially even start walking down the path to full-time ministry for some of these kinds of motivations? Now, I'm not, if you're on the path and you're like, what if this is it? I'm not saying quit, but talk to a wise, older, godly Christian and weigh out your motives. But it doesn't mean you wouldn't be in ministry. It just means you need to maybe adjust your motives ahead of time. So that's really fascinating. Even like what you do in church to serve, what ministries you pick to serve in, what ones you avoid because maybe you're not seen or whatever. That's really good, Charlie.
I think even outside of a local manifestation of the church, as well as we think about the church, it's feeling a lot of pressure. It's always discussed, you know, are you on the right side of history with social issues? And so the church is feeling all kinds of pressure to cave in and those things too, because it's much easier to be in the inner circle when culture, when you have to stand athwart culture. So that's another thing to think about.
Well, that made me think of when the Jews didn't want to lose their place with the Romans. Like, you can even see that there. They're trying to appease and so they can be accepted. Oh, that's fascinating.
And so just to, I mentioned a couple seconds ago, I want to read the next sentence. So like, I don't know how compromised you are. That was the sentence. And then right after that, I must not assume that you have ever first neglected and finally shaken off friends whom you really loved and who might have lasted you a lifetime in order to court the friendship of those who appeared to you more important, more esoteric. So like he says, I don't want to assume, but he's like stating his assumption. So I think that's masterful writing right there. So like, I don't want to assume that you, and I'll insert, this is kind of my interpretation of it. I don't want to assume that you, like me, had friends that you shouldn't have turned away from. Mm-hmm. And you went to other friends because you thought they were more important and you left the real friends behind. I'm not going to assume you did that. Mm. And you're like, ooh, like, so like who should be your, so it is a discussion of like the desire to be in, but I think nestled into this is too, like, who should your friends be? Mm-hmm. Like, why do you want those people to be your friends? So it's a really interesting talking point as well.
Lewis can't prescribe a solution to this because he wants the essay to be timeless, and it is. And so I'd like us to think a little bit about that too. He does mention at one point on page 56, this is my tidbit, this is the quotation, but also I think it launches us into, or at least thinking about possible solutions to the problem or ways to fight the problem. The quest of the inner ring will break your hearts unless you break it. But if you break it, a surprising result will follow. If, in your working hours, you make the work your end, you will presently find yourself all unawares inside the only circle in your profession that really matters.
Mm. Now that is good. It almost sounds reminiscent of... So he has another essay called First Things. And he talks about first things and second things, and he's riffing off of the kingdom of God, like, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and then all these things will be added unto you. And he says, if you aim at the wrong thing, you miss both, but if you aim at the right thing, you end up getting both. And I almost hear that as an echo in what he just said there, that aim at this, you know, put your hand to the plow, I guess. So well, that was really interesting. You guys have any other thoughts?
I think we've covered.
I think we've
covered a lot.
So anyways, I thought it was a helpful essay. So if you have not read it, after listening to this, go take a listen or go take a read.
All right, let's have a quick final meditation in Luke 18. Luke 18, and I'll be very honest about this. So one of the classes I teach is preaching to youth. Right before Josh teaches Intro to Literature in the same classroom. And it's one of the distinct joys of my life to heckle his students as they come in and say, what poetry are you talking about today? But anyway, one of my students preached on this text. And I'm not stating this of current students, past students, any students, but in general, sermons in homiletics classes aren't great. Okay, so you're not expecting to like be hit with something, you know. But I was really blessed by the message of this one. And so it has stuck with me over the last couple of weeks to the point where I've studied out more of the topic. It is about prayer. It's about prayer. And this is that wonderful parable where God uses a nagging widow to remind us of the need to be persistent in prayer. And so we'll read the text and also have a couple of really short thoughts to, I hope, quickly apply. And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. He said, in a certain city, there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, give me justice against my adversary. That's my interpretation of her voice, but it's probably close.
I think it sounded pretty accurate.
Yeah. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continuous coming. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God give justice to his elect, who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And so, very simple picture. There's a guy who doesn't care what you think, and he's a judge. He's supposed to care about justice, and he doesn't care what God thinks. He doesn't care what you think. He just wants to get his paycheck and go home. But then there's this widow who something has happened, and she keeps coming and saying, give me justice. Give me justice. And the point of the story is that he would normally not give in. He as a person, as a judge, would not give in. He doesn't care. But because she kept coming, he finally does give her justice. And we get a great argument from lesser to greater here. If the persistence of the widow can break the will of a non-God-fearing, non-man-respecting judge, what do you think a persistent prayer would do to a righteous judge who loves you? He will give you justice speedily. So it is a great encouragement to be persistent in prayer. And there are a handful of other passages that have similar ideas to them. But you know, there's a verse in the New Testament in 1 Thessalonians. Pray without ceasing. And you can hear that as a command, and that can maybe be burdensome. Like, what do you mean I have to pray all the time? And there's a lot of prayers I make, and they don't seem to get answers. And so why do I have to keep praying all the time? And the focus of the parable is not on what you do or do not get. It's focused on the character of God. And if you do believe and trust that God listens and wants to give justice, that he is a just God who does care for you, that you will keep praying. And I think we've talked many times before about, you know, going to God in prayer, like a James 4, and you're really just asking to get what you want. You're not at that point really praying. You're begging to get, you know, some fleshly desire. But when prayer starts with the character of God, then you have a really good motivation to pray all the time, because you know that because of God's character, he will answer. And there's other passages in the New Testament that say, you know, like, ask and it will be given, knock and the door will be open to you. And there's a tension in our humanness when we hear something like that, because we've all prayed for things that we haven't received them. I'm not sure that's really the point of those passages. It's not like, here's the magic formula to get what you want. It's like, hey, you should ask and you will receive, because God answers. Like, God is the person who wants to give you. And so trying to take the focus off of the answer or the end and put it on the character of God. And when you look at God for who he is, you want to be persistent in prayer. And so a simple reminder to be like an old widow and go every day and ask and ask and ask. And God will answer you. God is just and he will answer speedily. Sometimes his answer is no, but he will answer. So any thoughts on the widow? All right. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We will pick up this series in a couple of weeks, but we'll see you on another episode next week. And thanks again for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.